John Monet, you will be traveling to Sri Lanka for 7 weeks, and you will be visiting some seven, eight different places, or even 10, so you will get a good impression. It's the first time he's ever going to Sri Lanka, and brings back memories for me of my early days. It's actually almost exactly 30 years now that I arrived in Sri Lanka with the intention to ordain. This is one of my heroes. Do you know this monk? It's actually a German monk. He passed away in Sri Lanka in 2006 with 50 Vassa as a monk. As a young man, he was interested in being in Germany. He was interested in the beginning, it was more Hindu teachings, not so much. Buddhist, but now some people wouldn't even know the difference so well. So he was generally interested in Indian spiritual teachings. It was quite difficult. That was already under the Nazis. It was difficult for him to get out as a young man because of compulsory military service and the military build-up. But he managed with a major trading house, and he ended up living in Colombo as a representative of that trading company. And he told me he lived in quite the high life, those days, colonial life, when you come from a Western country, you're kind of automatically upper strata of society. And he said he was very fit and he could play tennis very well. But he still had these strong spiritual interests. And he was a strict vegetarian, Hindu style of practice. But then when the Second World War came, being a German national and Ceylon being a British colony, he was actually interned as a prisoner of war. And then they were all collected and transferred to Dehradun in India. That was the central internment camp for all members of the Axis powers. In Asia, in the British colonies. They had quite a good life there. They were even allowed to, on word of honor, they were allowed to go out and walk in the Himalaya. So it was fairly soft, but he was a very strict vegetarian. And just like in his later practice, he was willing to risk his life for that. And you can imagine that obviously the rations for prisoners of war in Second World War, they were not the biggest anyhow. And British kitchen is very heavy, on meat and eggs. Usually Indian style vegetarianism means also completely no eggs and no fish. And practicing strictly, if they had a stew where you had the potatoes and veggies and some meat, all boiled together. I'm pretty sure he wouldn't touch it at all because there's meat inside there, and then he wouldn't take out the potatoes or the veggies. He just wouldn't eat it. However, you couldn't actually survive like that. So he was losing weight and so on and became malnourished. And it was the influence of the German monks staying also as prisoners of war, who could convince him that this is not the teaching of the Buddha and that there's no point because there's no intention in his mind of harming or killing. If he just eats the food which is offered to him there without any choice as a prisoner of war. And gradually he moved from Hindu teachings to becoming a Buddhist. And then he was a very convinced Buddhist, and all he wanted to do was ordaining. But of course, as a prisoner of war in Second World War, you can't ordain as a monk. They would allow the monks actually to keep robes, and they would teach them, or they would treat them like the clerics of Christian religion, but still prisoners. So there must have been maybe 1942 or something like that, when he was then imprisoned, and all he wanted to do now was ordaining as a bhikkhu and really practicing. But no option. And after Second World War, because Ceylon was already getting close to becoming independent, the Sinhalese succeeded in convincing the British to send the German monks back to Sri Lanka, which was obviously very lucky for them. However, because Venerable Ñānavimala was only a layperson, they wouldn't do that. Even though he wanted to ordain, they would treat him as a layperson. And then in 46 or something, he was sent back to Germany. And of course, in those days in Germany, you just barely managed to survive. They had very cold winters and famine until 48, when the new currency came in and Marshall Plan and so on. It was very tough for 3 years. And there was obviously no way to really practice. He told me personally that his practice at that time was keeping the five precepts. And he realized it's about all he can do. But he was willing to do that at the cost of his life. He found board and lodging in a farmhouse. The farms were one place where they still have food. And he had to work 7 days a week, 12 hours a day, and just for food and lodging. But anyway, he could survive. But there's not much space for a Buddhist practice or ordaining or getting to Sri Lanka. And I know, he didn't mention that, but I know many people would survive by stealing some potatoes from a truck or doing some kind of illegal deals somehow on the black market. Or they would survive the cold in Berlin. The Central Park, the Deer Park in the center of the city, the big park, that was completely cut down because people would use it for heating in winter. Of course, it would be illegal, he wouldn't do that. It would be stealing the government property, cutting down the tree there. He wouldn't steal a few potatoes from a truck to survive or anything like that. He wouldn't lie. So it must have been really tough. But interestingly, he told me the possibly toughest, he was quite a young, healthy man. He had been imprisoned as a prisoner of war for quite a number of years, and now he was released, he was free again. And at some stage he found work as an English teacher, because having lived in Ceylon, he knew English well. And he said almost all his students were young women. And they were very interested in him because he was very polite and respectful and friendly and a Buddhist and very interesting because he had lived abroad and interesting religion. And he's a teacher. And there were very few men. But he said they were usually all married. And the husband, typically either prisoner of war or missing in action. So you don't know whether he's dead or prisoner or whatever, they don't know. But officially married, it would come under the third precept. Interestingly, he indicated that this was maybe even the most difficult one to keep. But this was his dedication. He realized he doesn't have much time and energy to develop samadhi and vipassana. He had no option to ordain in any way. And very tough situation, so he practiced five precepts, even at the cost of his life. And only in the 1950s, the Sri Lankans had bought this Buddhist house in Berlin. That was the jeweler, one wealthy jeweler, and he got that for a really good price. It was an old property from Dr. Dahlke, who was one of the first German Buddhists who had bought that in the north of Berlin. Perfect location on a little elevated on a tiny hill at the end of a beautiful boulevard. And they bought that to turn it into a temple. And they also started a German Dharma Dutta Society, a Buddhist missionary society. And then he volunteered to be one of the first missionaries. And the idea was to get him to Sri Lanka for 1 year and then send him back to Germany to be a Buddhist missionary. So that gave him a chance. Now they would pay his whatever travel costs to Sri Lanka. But after 1 year, Venerable Jnanavimala felt that he had barely scratched the surface of the Dhamma and that he is not now ready to really teach and be a missionary, because he felt, I first have to practice it myself. So he asked them permission whether he cannot rather stay on in Sri Lanka and become a monk. And the Dhamma Dutta Society, who had paid his tickets, never happy to give that permission. And then he became a monk with a delay of, I think, 12 years. So for 12 years, all he wanted to do is being a bhikkhu and practice, but impossible. And after 12 years, finally he was in Sri Lanka and was able to ordain. And then he lived in island hermitage, Polgarsdur, near Hekkadur, for 10 years, very secluded. It was the first Western monastery, actually. It was founded by the German monk Venerable Jnanatiloka in 1911. Venerable Jnanatiloka had actually tried, after ordaining in Myanmar and living in Ceylon for some time, he had tried to go back to Europe and start a first monastery in Europe. The first one was a kind of hut high in the Alps in Switzerland, and he almost died from the cold and so on, and bad food, and then he had lived in these tropical countries for so long, and that was not possible. And then he tried in Italy. There was a guy who offered, at least he said he wanted to offer property to the monks to start a monastery, and so they went there. He had a few disciples already, monk disciples. It turned out that the Italian guy had a mill on the property next door. And his idea was, and he gives the monks this property, but then the monks work 10 hours a day in his mill in exchange. So that was obviously also not really suitable. And he realized that the time wasn't ready, and he went back to Sri Lanka and started Island Hermitage, which was lucky because then First World War came. And he was in the end, he was also interned in First World War, and he couldn't stay there. Venerable Jnanatiloka had actually this adventure novel lifestyle, actually. The British were actually kind enough to set him free because he was cleric, a Buddhist monk. And then he tried to get to America, which was still neutral. But then realizing that America may enter the war, Venerable Jnanatiloka in Hawaii decided that he won't go to China. He was ordained in Myanmar, but Myanmar was also a British colony, so he couldn't go there. And Thailand had close connections with Britain, so they wouldn't let him in either. So he couldn't go to any of the Theravada Buddhist countries. And Germany was in war, wasn't suitable. And then his idea was to go to China and to travel to Yunnan province, which is on the border with Myanmar. Because there's a few Theravada Buddhists right across the border, and he felt sure that he could live there as a Theravada Buddhist monk. But China was in civil war, and that was the end of the Qing dynasty and so on, and the civil war. And he managed to get up the Yangtze Kiang until Chongqing, chunking, and then he got stuck, he couldn't get out. Anyway, this is where Venerable Jnana Vimala, an event, he had met Venerable Jnana Tiloka in the prisoner of war camp. And this is where he got ordained, and he lived the first 10 years. And he practiced so strictly now that he wouldn't talk. In fact, I've never met a monk who's so strict in terms of not making idle chatter. He would only talk in a straight Dhamma teaching or meditation discussion. You couldn't catch him for even just 2 minutes of chit-chat or small talk. And I read from one Western monk who stayed in island hermitage for 1 year when Venerable Jnana Vimala was living there, and he said he never talked a single word to him in that 1 year. But he still felt that he was the most inspiring monk he had ever met from his dedicated practice. And after the 10 years in island hermitage, when he felt his practice was stable enough and he had learned the foundations, it's not that he didn't talk with anyone. One of his teachers was Venerable Jnanamuli, the well-known English translator of the Visuddhimagga and the life of the Buddha and so on. And he learned the ropes from him, a little bit from Jnana Tiloka, but he was very old by then. And once he felt he had all the foundations, also in his meditative practice, then he started going on Charvika, on Tudong. And he became famous for 25 years, wandering all over Sri Lanka. He walked even in Tamil areas, he walked in Christian areas, Muslim areas, and is subsisting completely on alms food. He carried all his possessions, just in 2 little monk shoulder bags. He had studied the Dhamma and Vinaya very well. And then he had used these little school exercise books which the pupils use in school, these little books where you write. And he had managed to summarize the whole Sutta Pitaka and the Vinaya in these 2 little books using German shorthand. I'm not sure whether anyone nowadays still knows shorthand. Before recordings and so on, the people could write so quick in shorthand that they could make minutes by writing down everything that was said. It's a very abbreviated way of writing. And he used his own abbreviation system to make it even shorter and make the repetitive phrases to just mark them and so on. And he could find any quote in these 2 little booklets. Very impressive. And then he practiced it. He would also know Dhammapada by heart and Patimokkha by heart and many important suttas by heart. And the best he could find in these booklets. And you can already see on that photo, look at his robe. Is it a really nice 100% cotton or silk robe with a perfect hue, this nice reddish, orangey, yellowish color, beautiful? It's a shabby old robe, most likely in a plastic, polyester or something. In the old days, the monks would have rag robes and they would just pick up any pieces of cloth discarded and they would collect them, boil it all, make it aseptic, then dye it, and then make a patchwork robe. But nowadays, and even though it says in Sri Lanka, it was easy to get some robe, a finished robe. But most monks, they prefer a nice cotton robe in a nice color. And not an unpleasant looking, sweaty polyester robe. And you can see, he wouldn't bother. Some cheap, shabby robe. The one story which really expresses his frugality and contentment, important qualities, the santukti, contentment, is a very highly praised qualities for monks. Apichita, not being ambitious, not trying to be famous, to have few wishes. At some stage he was robbed in a remote part of Sri Lanka by some poor robbers. And he had to completely undress except for his underrobe. Everything else he had to give them. But what he did, he would just walk away some distance and hide in the bushes. And then after some time, when the robbers had left, he would go back to that place. And he would look around and he found all his possessions. All his possessions were so old and shabby that even these dirt poor robbers in the remote part of Sri Lanka decades ago were not interested in keeping anything. They didn't give it back out of kindness, they just threw it away because they were not interested. These exercise books completely filled with writing. If they were not completely filled, they may have pulled out the paper because even the paper was valuable. But it was completely written on, they couldn't use it. If they were robbing me, I'm pretty sure they would keep this one. Then my sandals, I'm pretty sure they would keep that. He didn't have any sandals, he was always barefoot. Or glasses, just some cheapo, I think it was $40 or $20 reading glasses. But in Sri Lanka those days they were quite valuable, people didn't have that, they would keep that. But although he carried all his possessions, the robbers didn't find a single thing that they considered worthwhile keeping. And 30 years ago, in Ajahn Muneyo, in March 2024, I arrived in Sri Lanka from India in March 1994. And the first time I spent in a Buddhist monastery was actually over Sinhalese New Year in April, I think 2 weeks over Sinhalese New Year. I went first to this meditation center in the mountains, Nilambe, with Godwin. Those days he was a famous Sri Lankan lay teacher. In a sense I liked it, but it wasn't quite what I was looking for, and more eclectic and new agey, a little bit hippie, and all kinds of people from all over the world who are interested in spiritual practice in a wider sense. It was actually very nice, I liked it, but it didn't feel like quite right. And one of the guys in that center told me about Venerable Jnanavimala and Island Hermitage. I didn't know about it. So I wrote a letter to him, because a little bit I heard sounded very inspiring. I wrote a letter in Island Hermitage, Venerable Jnanavimala, and if I can come and stay for 2 weeks. And I actually got an answer back from an Austrian monk who stayed on that Island Hermitage, and he informed me that Venerable Jnanavimala doesn't write letters. But very kindly he passed that one on, and he answered that, and I was welcome to stay for 2 weeks. When I got a chance talking with him, he explained a bit more about that. And he said when he ordained as a monk, his teacher, Venerable Jnanatiloka, one of the first Western monks, a German who started Island Hermitage in 1911, the one I mentioned earlier, he considered him his teacher. And he said, he gave me the following advice, that was somewhere in the 1930s or 40s, probably 1940s or maybe 50s. And he said, if you get mail in Sri Lanka and from Germany, what you do, you put that in the drawer of your desk. And then after 3-4 months, you open it and you read it, and you will find 90% of all matters already settled. No need to answer, to comment on it, it's all impermanent. After 3-4 months, 90% of whatever that letter concerned is already obsolete and gone and over. That was the standard of a good scholar monk, Venerable Jnana Tiloka, in the 1950s. I mean, nowadays people couldn't imagine that with the WhatsApp and Insta and email and mobile phone. However, Venerable Jnana Vimala wasn't a scholar monk. He was a very ascetic, meditative forest monk, so his standard was stricter. His standard was that he wouldn't write at all. I mean, for sure, now, there will be many people nowadays who don't write at all, you know, because they are texting and talking, but that was the only means of communication. It was the only means of cultivating a relationship with lay supporters when you're always walking. He's not in one monastery. So it means you don't have any support. If something happens, you get sick. You're in a village where people don't know you, who you are. You're just sitting there as a visitor in a temple or under a tree. When you get sick, you will obviously not have that much support. Whereas if you write letters, then you can write to your wealthy supporter, and then they will get a hired car, whatever, get you out, drive you to hospital. But he would let go of all of that. So I considered myself very lucky, very auspicious, that when I went to Island Hermitage, she was a senior monk there. And the second monk was Singhalese, who was the official abbot. Venerable Jnana Vimala would obviously not take on the responsibilities of abbotship, because he would want to protect his 100% dedicated practice. And then the next one was Bhante Guttasila. Ajahn Munay, you will be visiting him in Lagale. I think Bhante Guttasila is now the most senior Suduhamthru, most senior Western monk in Sri Lanka. So I was very lucky that these two senior Westerners, the one is one of the most outstanding Western monks in many people's opinion. The other one is also still in robes. And another one who was there was Venerable Metta Vihari. He's probably not so well known, but he did a lot in Buddhist television and so on. He worked a lot for that in Sri Lanka. Yeah, all these memories coming up with Ajahn Munay, you're going to Sri Lanka. I remember after the meal, Venerable Jnana Vimala would always go back straight to his kuti. And one day it started raining, so I thought this is a good excuse to go with him to his kuti, to hold the umbrella for him. He was quite elderly, with a stick walking, hold an umbrella for him to his kuti, and maybe get a chance to chat a little bit more. But then he would just laugh about the rain. He told me, no need to come in. I said, it's raining. He just started laughing. Because he must have been so much in the rain during his tudong, the charika. Didn't mind a few drops. And he immediately put me onto anatta. Because I had written that I have been traveling for half a year in India. And of course, so many of the Hindu teaching, they teach about the Atman. So he asked me, you've been in India, What is your understanding of the Atta, the Atman? I didn't quite know how to answer that. And then he immediately put me onto the teaching of Anatta as a hallmark of the Buddhist teachings and one crucial distinction to Hindu teachings. It was very helpful. And some advice I got for him, which has always stayed with me. Now the first was to make an effort and study the original teaching of the Buddha, to really study the authentic word of the Buddha, and not just to read, but to make notes and learn important things by heart, and really work it through, just like you're learning for exam in uni. It's not just you're just reading books, but you have to really commit it to memory and understanding. And in particular, he pointed out that means the original Buddha Vacha, so not Visuddhimagga, the famous commentary, not the commentaries, not the Jatakas or the Abhidhamma, but the Sutta Pitaka, particularly the older part of it, and the Vinaya. There was the other advice, wherever I ordain, because I asked him about that and he didn't want to commit to any concrete recommendation, but he said the basic condition is that the Vinaya is kept properly. The essential of keeping the original Vinaya rules, that was the other advice. The third advice I didn't keep very well, that is about going arms round. But it's obviously easier in Sri Lanka. You talk mostly about what you do in a traditional Buddhist country, and that was his practice. He would always go arms round. Another one was the importance of samadhi. That may sound maybe not quite trivial, but not so spectacular. But even when I met him in 1994, meditation in Sri Lanka was almost synonymous with Mahasi, the famous Mahasi Sayadaw, the Burmese technique known as Vipassana. Nowadays people think on Vipassana mostly Goenka, but Goenka those days wasn't so big yet. But Mahasi Sayadaw and his disciples, Venerable Upandita, Ujjanaka, they were very famous, and almost any meditative tradition amongst monks in Sri Lanka, this is what they would practice. And they had a very strong emphasis on Vipassana without samadhi, to the extent that they sometimes would even discourage developing samadhi. But Venerable Jnanavimala is coming from the suttas and obviously noticing the very strong importance the Buddha has given to samadhi and jhana, he would be in a completely solitary in that approach those days. You would have only the monks who practiced Mahasi style, or you would have scholar monks who would teach meditation from the scholarly commentary scriptures. But he was so dedicated, and he would just go his way and practice exactly how Sutta Vinaya is teaching. So that was also a very helpful foundation to get me started, that we have to develop samadhi. Of course, we also have to develop wisdom and insight, but no one is denying that anyhow. I have never heard any Buddhist practitioner saying that one doesn't have to develop wisdom and insight. It's uncontroversial. But it can happen that people are kind of poo-pooing or underplaying the importance of samadhi, or even saying that's a waste of time. So here was the opposite. Important, samadhi important. So I feel very grateful for this foundation he has given me there. Happy I got an opportunity with Ajahn Muneyo going to Sri Lanka to talk about one of my heroes. I met him the last time just before I left in 1998. By then he was already in bed. He couldn't walk anymore. The only thing was once a day the attending monk would have him supported by two people, that he would walk a few steps to the other end of the room and then back. And then he would collapse back in his bed and be completely exhausted. But obviously, as long as you can still get up, and it's good to do it. So I remember once being one of the two and supporting him. And you could notice his iron determination and this willpower he had in his practice. In this case, just to do these few steps. And he put everything into that, that he could still walk in a few steps. It was interesting you described, and he said you have to be really practicing well when you're young. And he said, no, my body was just like yours. And when I, in the 1930s, I lived the high life in colonial Ceylon and playing tennis, really good tennis player, and young and fit and healthy. And he said, now look at me. And he was just obviously very decrepit. He had this huge hernia, which they didn't operate for many years. And he said, no, you have to practice before you're at that stage. But if you have a foundation, and then he described, and he said, then it's no problem. And he said, no, you're just lying there and contemplating that everything is impermanent, the feeling, the body. And he said, no, you fall asleep, and even in your dreams, you continue in contemplating everything is impermanent. And then you wake up and you're happy. And it sounded very impressive. And you see this decrepit old man lying in bed. And he's describing now you're contemplating impermanence even in your dreams, and how you're going to wake up happy, unconcerned with a decaying body. Very impressive. He never complained, the attendant monk. If you look after really old and sick people, you may notice when they're sick and pain and so on, they tend to have issues and complain about this and that. But the attendant monk, he never asks for anything, he never complains about anything. So my little homage to Venerable Jnana Vimala, very outstanding monk. And I was so lucky that he was a senior monk when I first stayed in a Buddhist monastery. Yeah, he never left again. He would often discourage people when they wanted to leave, particularly monks, Western monks. Because he would say that you have everything that is required to practice as a bhikkhu to attain nirvana here in Sri Lanka. So why would you want to go to India or anywhere? He wanted to encourage people and not to travel. Although he did this charvika himself, going all over Sri Lanka, he actually said it's a very difficult practice. And it works only if you have a good foundation in samadhi and very strong sense restraint. And he said, if you do tudong, charvika, but you notice that sense impressions impact your mind, for example, it becomes more touristy, you go somewhere because you enjoy seeing it, then you should go back into solitude and reestablish your samadhi and sense restraint. So he didn't do that for enjoyment.